All right. Well, this is amazing. The All-Star Game is in the books. Love talking about the All-Star Game. Actually, that's not true. We're recording this well in advance because I'm actually on vacation right now. The one chance we get a chance to do that during the NBA season is the All-Star weekend. But hopefully this won't have changed too much in the three games that we missed between now and recording. We're going to do our center rankings, which is one that I have been looking forward to doing today because there are so many weird contracts at the center position. Just so many guys at the center position, a position that is really evolving, in some ways has more talent than it's ever had, and in some ways is less valued than it's ever been.
It's also remarkable how few truly elite defenders there are at the position. I mean, I've always thought of the center spot as defense first and being the centerpiece of that, and you could think back even as recently as, you know, Marc Gasol's role on those Grizzlies teams or all that, and there are certainly a few very high-end defenders, and there are a couple that will be in my tier one, but there are a lot of really offensively gifted guys, and some of that is also, I think, that while the best of the best right now have been good defenders their entire career, some of these guys are offensively gifted and I think will get better. They won't become dominant, and so I want to see how that moves, and that could be a big differentiator for which guys, especially of the young guys, which is something I want to talk about, move into various tiers in this conversation.
I think the other thing that really stands out about this position is the depth, and I think you could make the argument that once you get to maybe about the 25th best center in the NBA, there's not that big of a difference between the 25th best and the 45th best in terms of your actual results on the court. Certainly you could compare the skill sets of those players and say, hey, this guy is nowhere near as skilled as this guy is. But when you really look at it on the court, you can get by with having the 45th best center in the NBA as a starter, and then put your resources into other positions. Whereas if you look at, say, the 25th best shooting guard or small forward in the NBA versus the 45th best, now you just have a massive difference where you've got a guy who's just a huge liability on one end of the floor or the other. And so I think that's very interesting. I mean, there are a lot of quality players at this position, but if you just kind of have a guy who, like, okay, so he'll protect the rim a little bit, he'll get some rebounds and set some screens, you're not that bad off.
The other element of this, and it's been a challenge when we structure these in terms of positions, is that there are a lot of players who can play center who aren't on this list because they're primarily power forwards. And so Anthony Davis, we had on the center list, LaMarcus Aldridge, Kristaps Porzingis, we did that list before his ACL tear. It's possible that after this, we'll see how he is, that he might just be a center from now on. So those types of guys can do it. And that versatility is important, especially for guys like Serge Ibaka and Draymond Green, who can be smaller ball centers in closing lineups. So they're not on this list. Those are guys that can play center, but these are guys who it's their primary position on a normal team. That's what they would be. And that's where we really drew the line. And the issue, as it always is on the edges of it, is that these guys don't have as much situational versatility because that's why they're centers. There are a couple guys that can play four, some that actually do, but for the most part, these are five only guys.
Yeah. And you can of course make the argument that so many teams' best lineups include a Draymond Green or an Anthony Davis playing center rather than playing at power forward. And so you just don't need as many minutes out of traditional centers as you once did. And so we'll remind you here of the criteria before we get into it, and just determining what's a center or power forward. I think we got into that more in the power forward rankings. But you know, the more you skew towards being a 7-footer, the more you skew towards having a little bit more half to defend in the post, still somewhat of a concern for centers, although not an enormous one. That's another way in which this position has evolved. In addition to offensive rebounding being less important, post defense is less important. And so having guys who are just kind of ground bound and strong, but not really that quick, you know, it doesn't add as much as it used to when the offensive boards and the defensive boards, for that matter, and defending in the post aren't nearly as strong. I mean, it used to be if you didn't have someone who could defend in the post, you're just going to get cooked all day long by the other team's center, and you'd have to double team, and that would open up all sorts of stuff. Whereas now that's not really a concern. You can kind of have a skinny guy there, a more mobile guy. And so center defense really has become much less about defending in the post, but still somewhat important to have some half. The less you can shoot from the outside, the more you're a center. The less you can switch, the more you're a center or guard on the perimeter. And it's just, who are you guarding? Are you guarding the other team's center when you're out there? That's a big part of this too. And then if we're going to try and figure out, okay, who's better, how are we going to determine who's better? The inquiry is, who would we want for the rest of this season and and the playoff.
And the playoff part of this is important too, especially as we get into the later guys. There are certain players that just their value decreases substantially at that point. And also, as is commonplace for us in these, we separate into tiers. And the way that works for me, and I think you would agree with this, is that within a tier, the margins are much closer, and then the separations are important. So you might have a couple of different guys in the same tier, and people shouldn't be like, oh, you had this guy over that guy. You know, those are generally pretty close, and then the separations there. Some of the separations are really hard in the center spot, just because you're drawing a line when the differences, as you said in the outset, are different. But that's the idea. The idea is that within a tier, especially in the later ones when we stop, you know, it's more about just this group of guys. Don't focus as much on which name we say first.
The differences are different, which sounds completely nonsensical when I repeat it out of context like that, but actually made perfect sense when you said it. All right, we'll get started here. I was going to say without further ado, but there will be ado, because I want to tell you about our friends at Indochino. These suits are special because they actually fit you. If you've been toiling with suits that do not fit in this day and age, there's just no excuse for that anymore. There was a time when I was a lawyer, when I was coming out of law school, first I went to like Men's Warehouse, and you know, they claimed that they could alter it and they couldn't. And like, you know, the being a tall guy, the matching pants for the suit jacket that ostensibly fit me, which it didn't, were like size 40. My waist is 34. So they had to like cinch it in and it all like billowed out around my waist. I didn't have pleats, but it almost looked like I had pleats anyway. It was really bad. And then I was like, all right, you know, I'm starting to make some money as a lawyer here. I'll go to like a nice department store and I'll get a suit. And I don't care how much it costs. Like, I need to get a suit that fits me. And so, you know, I spent like $1,000 on a suit one time. And oh, hey, guess what? Even after 3 weeks of tailoring, still didn't fit me. Really a massive disappointment. And then I heard about Indochino. Went into their San Francisco showroom. They got my measurements and they've made me a bunch of suits and shirts now that fit me exactly the way they're supposed to. And they're mine. I'm not like, oh, hey, these are the pants that fit with this suit off the rack. We're going to make it, cinch it in for you. No, it's actually mine. The fabric is one of dozens that they have that I chose. I customized the lapels. I customized the lining. I got this sweet vest as well. If you can't make it to their showroom, you can just, they have a tutorial of how to measure yourself online. You can send in your measurements. 3 to 4 weeks later, your suit arrives. And what's more, it's only $359 and free shipping with that familiar promo code CAPSPACE. Easy to remember, we talk about CAPSPACE all the time here on the program. That's Indochino.com. 50% off the regular price for a premium made to measure suit using that promo code CAPSPACE. Everyone that I've talked to about Indochino loves it. I've recommended it just even in my personal life to many people. They like it. Probably going to actually just get all the stuff for my groomsmen at Indochino as well. Indochino.com, promo code CAPSPACE. All right, drumroll, Danny. I want to know who your number one was.
My number one is Joel Embiid, which is remarkable when you consider that he's at about a season's worth of games right now in his entire career. But what makes him different is that he's an effective, at times dominant offensive player, and is still my pick for defensive player of the year. And that double is different. You know, there are other guys who have a lot of talent, but I don't doubt his ability to stay on the floor in the playoffs. He does have flaws, but I think he's the best individual player.
Yeah, I think that's who I had as well. My only reason to have some pause in that, and I had him in a tier, the first tier by himself, in fact, because he's really the only guy to me who combines elite scoring and elite defense. And also, you know, he can scale because he stretches the floor a little bit too. And just, I mean, if you look at this Philly roster, it's like him and Ben Simmons and Robert Covington and JJ Redick, and that's like 13. Like, it's four guys. And you see the ridiculous drop off when he doesn't play. You see that he's struggled a little bit in pick and roll defense lately, and I'm still very interested to see how he does in the playoffs when he has to get out on the floor more against elite offenses, assuming they actually match up with one of those before losing in the Eastern Conference playoffs, and assuming they make it, which they seem on track to do. So really my only concern, I mean, and also just the rate at which he's improved throughout the year. I mean, if you're going to say just for the rest of this season, the playoffs, who do you want? Like, you could probably bake in a little bit of improvement there for him as well, just to see how far he's come in things like passing out of the post in this season. And he's such a matchup nightmare, but not only because he can shoot threes, but he's really, he and Towns, because DeMarcus doesn't even really post up that much anymore. He and Towns are the only two centers you look at where you're like, oh, like, if we don't have like a real center to guard this guy, we're in trouble. Like, he's just going to get deep position in the post and go through us and get fouled every time. And then when you throw in that the other team has to keep a center on the floor, the fact that that center still has to guard him out at the three-point line as well, even though he's not hitting as many this year, that he's still, the scouting report on him is that he can shoot it, and so teams need to take that away, and then he can put it on the floor. And then just like the ridiculous deterrent effect that he has at the rim, he's probably top two or three in that category just as a straight rim protector, and he's got great feel as well, and he's playing as many minutes and as many games now as most centers are. So I'm worried a little bit that he could just get hurt later in the year, but other than that, he's just been unbelievable this year.
Embiid is also a different type of plug and play guy, but why he works in that is that you can fit him with a lot of other surrounding talent because he's a good two-way player. He can anchor your defense, he can do that, so you can have different approaches. You probably wouldn't want, there are certain defensive schemes you wouldn't maximize with him, but I've been thinking about, like, what if you had a pick and roll ball handler who could really shoot off the dribble? Like, he would kill with that kind of a guy. Simmons, they figured a lot of this out, but you could use a lot of different offenses and he could do well. And defensively, of course, he's been magnificent so far this year. This might be unfair because it's putting you on the spot. Anthony Davis is not on this list because we counted him as a power forward. Would you have had him over Embiid? Because I'm pretty sure I would have.
Yes. Yeah, the one thing that gives me a little pause about Davis is just the fact that he's so inconsistent from night to night. But, especially if he could play in a system where he didn't have to be the number one offensive engine all the time and play some more defense. I mean, when he's played center, when they've had some good defense pieces around him, he's been elite defensively as well. Not as good as Embiid, but still excellent. And he's got the ability to get out on the floor also. All right, so who else? Did you have anyone else in your top tier? I did not, as I mentioned.
I did, because of Joel Embiid's injury. If health were equal between these three guys, I would have Embiid in tier one by himself, but I had Towns and Gobert in my tier one as well. And it's funny to have to mark Embiid down for injury stuff and Gobert, who has missed a bunch of time, including this season, on there. But it's just, with the foot stuff, with Embiid and at back and everything else like that. But Towns and Gobert are both just spectacular talent. So I think on talent, they're a different tier, but for the practical matter of who you want for the rest of the season, I have them in the same.
Yeah, and that's totally fair. I had the same top three as you did. I had Towns and Gobert in tier two by themselves. Towns, easily the best offensive center in the NBA, to my mind, which is a shame that he gets, the seventh most shots on the team every night now, which is just absolutely completely insane. But we know that he can scale up and maintain his efficiency as he plays more. I mean, and you just to imagine, like, if he was on a team with some real spacing and shooting around him, what he could do in the post, because he's very much just dependent on, like, shooting threes. He's shooting 40% on threes this year. Efficiency is through the roof. We saw last year his usage rate was in the high 20s. No real drop in efficiency. And I mean, when you look even at, like, the RPM numbers, he's by far the best center there, by far the most versatile offensive center in terms of all the things that he could do: offensive rebound, pick and roll, pick and pop, post up, turn and face, spot up, take guys off the dribble, get out in transition. I mean, he can do absolutely everything offensively. I mean, he's, if not the most complete offensive player that we've ever seen in the NBA at the center position, he's very, very close.
And he could even get better. I mean, just if you gave the circumstances and the time to get used to where the NBA is going, and I shudder at where he could end up being offensively. And then defensively, it's been inconsistent, to be sure.
Well, one more thing too. I mean, I think it's real on his offense, it's really underrated how good he is in the post. Like, there is nobody I've seen who can stop him in the post. Like, his size and strength is, like, he gets to the spot that he wants to get to just about every time. I mean, he doesn't look like the most jacked guy, but for whatever reason, he's able to get to his spot. And then his touch with both hands around the rim on hook shots, he can go to the fadeaway. I mean, he's got everything. It's remarkable. But you want to start talking about his defense now? I guess we have to.
We do have to. And he has the physical potential to be a good defender. Though I was watching the game, which at this point when this gets released, it'll been more than a week ago against Chicago. And the way he runs does concern me a little bit. I feel like I'm channeling Ethan saying that. But it's just, there's something weird about the way he moves in that sort of open space, which is so different from the way.
Well, it's there's something weird about the way he runs when he's going from the basket that his team is shooting at towards the basket that the other team is shooting at. He looks fantastic when he's running the other direction. I mean, like, if you see him really turn it on and sprint, I mean, that's what's so disappointing about his transition defense in particular, is, like, when he really sprints the floor, like, he looks like a gazelle to me. But, like, when he jogs back, I know what you mean. He kind of, like, waddles his hips from side to side, and, like, it doesn't really look look like right, but like when he really kicks it into gear, like he looked very fluid to me.
And defensively, I was getting this before. He has the physical potential to be a very good. I mean, and he's a smart player. I wouldn't expect him, especially with the offensive load that he should be carrying, to ever be dominant in that way. But at a certain point, and this happens a lot with perimeter guys as well, you start having to talk about how potential is less relevant than what they've actually done. And so they have had a couple nice moments. I will love to see at the end of the year how that coincides with when they've used Tyus Jones versus Jeff Teague, because part of the issue with Towns is just what happens when the perimeter is less sound than it is at a certain other points. But he's not making the difference there that the two other guys I have in this tier, Joel Embiid and Rudy Gobert, are, where those guys, you have to account for them defensively, you game plan for them, opposing teams do when they're on offense, and you see how they affect almost every single possession.
Yeah, and Towns, the stats are pretty ugly. 56th in the NBA in defensive RPM among centers. And the talk was that he'd gotten a little bit better and a little bit more active, and I'd noticed that to some degree to be the case in December and January. And then, you know, the Wolves' defense a bit better. And then you look up and in their last 10 games, they're 30th in the NBA in defensive rating. So he's still got a ways to go. I do think, especially in terms of switching out on the perimeter, if you were playing in a system where they did more of that, perhaps that would enable him to be a little bit more valuable. But the rim protection, the effort, and really, I mean, the number one thing to me is the transition, that he just is really bad at getting back. And getting your big men back is just so important to the integrity of your transition defense. But he's still a wonderful player. Rudy Gobert, you know, did not really have a great start to the season, was in and out of the lineup. Then he missed time with that contusion, that knee contusion. And since he's been back, though, I think he's announced that he is right there. His offense is underrated in terms of the gravity that he has getting to the rim. The strides that he's made as a finisher since he first came into the league are remarkable. And he's able now to not, you know, catch the ball down low and not really get bumped off as much and go up for dunks, avoid the charge. He can even make a few passes at times as well. He's an excellent screener. He's regularly in the top of the league in screen assists, although that's in part because Utah runs the most pick and rolls in the NBA. But he is a solid offensive player. And then defensively, I think what he's done on a per play basis this year, I think he's a better defensive player than Joel Embiid, better recognition, better feet, and close to, if not the absolute same force that Embiid is protecting the rim. And he's even shown some in individual defense too. I mean, he shut down Anthony Davis playing at center a few nights ago against the Pelicans. I mean, he's really had, against pretty much everyone except, you know, maybe Houston or Golden State, he's probably the best defensive player in the NBA, just because he can stay with just about anyone that he needs to in conventional pick and roll defense.
And he can clean up so many messes that other teams, and so you think about what he could be on teams with less stout perimeter defense, he can help with that, and like so many centers that we've seen in the past. And a way to differentiate for me Gobert and Nikola Jokic, who is in my next tier, he's not my next player, but he's in my next tier, is that Gobert's defense to me is better than Jokic's offense, but it's pretty close. But why he's ahead of him is because defense is more important than offense to me for a center, and because Gobert is better on his weak side offense than Jokic is on his weak side.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you just, and the reason for that is, you know, if you have a bad defensive center, you're almost always going to have a bad defense. And if you have a bad offensive center, you can get offense in other places. It certainly hurts, but you can get offense in other places. You can't get that defense in other places when the guy who's your last line of defense, if he's failing all the time, there's no one else who can make up for that defensively. So let's get into the tier three. And DeMarcus is in this tier for me. Obviously he's out for the year, so it's not really fair to say, okay, who would you want for the rest of this season? Because he wouldn't be on the list at all. He's not going to play. But just if you wanted to project what we think he'll be after returning from the Achilles and where it would fit in here, that's what I tried to do. So he was at the bottom of this tier for me. But my number four player and at the top of tier three, which includes four players overall, was Al Horford.
Al Horford is my number four as well. I titled this tier Almost, where these guys are...
Yeah, these groupthink center ratings.
Oh, they're not going to stay the same for very long. But Horford is a challenge because part of why he has looked so good is that he's such a perfect fit for what Boston is doing. He's defensively, he can play power forward and center. He can be a part of their offense without dominating. His usage is actually below 20%. And that's, you know, if you think about all the positions equally, but that works.
Yeah. Which in some ways is a knockout.
It is too, because Boston could use a little bit more from him. He's been an effective player. And he's not consistently dominant enough to me to be in that next tier. year, but on certain teams, he can be incredibly valuable. So for me, that's why he's over Jokic, just because I like a guy at that who's a little bit more balanced, and Jokic is, his imbalance is on the side that it's a little bit more negative, just because we do have these questions about how good a team can be defensively if he is their center.
Yeah, we do. And for Horford, what he's done in terms of his three-point shooting since arriving in Boston has really been a game changer, because in that DHO game, you really got to get out on him. He can space the floor at center, and the versatility of his jump shot has really improved as well from three. He's able to get those shots off quickly, which was did not used to be the case for him. He's still money for mid-range if they need him there, and he can get into the post or put the ball on the floor and make the right decision. I mean, he's not really a plus option posting up against guys his size, but if you get him in the post on a switch, he can be effective. And then defensively, one of the smartest defenders in the NBA, has the feet to switch with most smalls. I mean, there's still a few that are going to beat him, but, and he's not incredibly explosive, but he's a solid enough shot blocker. He'll take charges, and he's just the quarterback of the defense. I mean, you might say that Horford, and because he's averaging like 13 points a game now, you know, I'm sure there are plenty of people who are like, how could he be this high? He's averaging 13 a game. DeMarcus averages, you know, 29 a game or whatever it was. But I would say that Al Horford might be the player in the NBA for whom box score stats do the most injustice. Like, he does the most stuff of any player in the NBA that doesn't show up. I mean, whether it's spacing the floor, whether it's switching defensively, denying penetration, whether it's just reversing the ball, setting fantastic screens. He's a great screen setter, totally illegally, of course, but a great screen setter. And all of that is the stuff that doesn't show up in the conventional stat sheet that he is elite at. And that's why he's this high on both of our lists.
For those who are questioning this, one thing you could watch is particularly the first quarter or the first half of that Celtics-Warriors game, where he was just everywhere, and it didn't show up a lot in the stat sheet. And they're a particularly hard team defensively for they expose a lot of people. And
yeah, he's out there like blocking Kevin Durant and Steph Curry and Klay Thompson three-pointers in that first half. Like, it was
and
remarkable.
So that's why he's over Jokic to me. Jokic, spectacular offensive player, not the same guy he was last year for a couple different reasons, some of that being Mike Malone going back to playing him with centers, which I think is just a huge mistake. And that's actually toning down now that Plumlee got hurt. And we kind of know the book on him to a point. Oh, one other thing with Horford, his defensive rebounding is a big concern. Then that's a serious weak point. And also part of the reason why he wasn't seriously considered for tier one, because yes, he is playing some power forward, and that's certainly, you know, playing next to another big is going to lower your defensive rebound rate. But he's just not a great defensive rebounder. Those Hawks teams were not as good at defensive rebounding as you would have expected as well, but they were still a great defense because there are other parts of that are important.
Yeah. Jokic was my number five as well. At six, I had Andre Drummond, who to me has really come on defensively this season. He's had, the last few times I've watched him playing, some of the best defense of his career, really affecting things at the rim. He's got the versatility and quick feet. He's he might have the best hands and quickness in short areas of any center on this list, because maybe unless you're going to go down to like kind of a Jordan Bell type of range, because he really has, and this isn't a coverage that a lot of teams play as much anymore, is being able to get up to the level of the ball in pick and roll, get his hands on balls, force guys to give it up, get steals, and then get back into the play with his superior speed. And then around the rim, he's just been more of a force. Fantastic defensive rebounder. Up until they made these trades, he was basically the only guy in their team who ever got a defensive rebound. And he's not doing as much of the DeAndre Jordan, hey, get out of here, this is my rebound, when it's uncontested. And then offensively, completely changed the nature of his game this year. The terrible post-ups have largely been excised. That's helped his efficiency. Making the free throws has been enormous as well, at a rate where he's not getting intentionally fouled anymore, where he can be on the floor at the end of games and not have guys just like grab him as he goes to set a screen and put him on the foul line. And then the passing that he's had from the elbows has been remarkable. That's probably going to go down a little bit with the arrival of Blake Griffin, but he was helping with his passing a very limited offensive team squeeze out points. So, and then the offensive rebounding remains, you know, one of the best, if not the best, in the NBA, probably the second best behind Steven Adams at this point. So all of that really, I mean, I still have questions about his defensive intelligence, about consistent effort level, but he's made the type of strides this year that I think we've been waiting for him to make for a long time, and maybe questioned that he could make.
That history of being burned before with him is why I have him in the same spot, but I don't have him in the same tier. And it's a lot like Victor Oladipo for me, where if he does this for a whole year, especially because if the Pistons make the playoffs, I will absolutely have him in tier two, in the next year, because our tier numbers are different, wholeheartedly. But I need to see a little bit more of it, because last year, I don't think he materially affected the Pistons defense as much as I hoped. And that can be improvement, that the young players still getting better. The surrounding talent is different. Last year's Pistons team was such a disaster for portions of the year anyway. So I'm just a little bit conservative with that. I try to always be in that way. And one thing I want to say, so my tier two was only two guys, and Cousins was originally there.
Yeah, Horford and Jokic, right?
Cousins was originally there, but with the uncertainty of what he's going to be after his Achilles injury, he is in the next tier for me with Drummond and a few other guys.
Yeah, and Cousins, you know, where would he have been for you if he were healthy?
He would have been between Jokic and Drummond in the same tier with Jokic and Horford.
Okay, yeah, that makes
and
sense.
And let's talk about Cousins now. I think now is a good time to do it. And he is such a phenomenally offensively talented player, and his defensive potential is certainly there. I mean, you see certain elements of the way he moves, and he can, at certain points when he cares, he can react well, but he has a couple of bad habits that are at the point now where it concerns you about his reliability, and it concerns you about his place on a successful team. So his defensive effort and execution is certainly high on that list, but also his propensity to just get completely out of control in terms of fouls, taking bad shots, all those kind of things. I mean, you're sitting there going, well, if he's
bitching to the refs, not getting back on defense.
So if you're sitting there and going, okay, well, what are we going to get from him in a playoff series? Remember, he has never played in the playoffs. You wouldn't be comfortable.
Right. A lot of these guys, you kind of wonder about that. We haven't seen much of them at the highest levels yet.
And so that's a concern with Jokic as well. And he complains to the refs too. But
it's a concern with Jokic. Embiid hasn't been in the playoffs. Carl Towns, Rudy Gobert has only played eight games in the playoffs.
Drummond has some, but not a ton of real like relevant information.
Yeah, he's played four games. They got swept. Jokic hasn't been in the playoffs at all. So I mean, really, out of our top seven guys, the only one that we've seen extensively in the playoffs is Al Horford. You know, so and it's tough to say. I mean, we're ranking these guys in the regular season, and Horford, he's had some disappointing playoff runs to be sure. But nonetheless, I mean, he's not a guy who defensively is just going to get exploited. You know, whereas when you see a guy at the highest level, when teams have a chance to scout you, that's when you really get an idea of what their weaknesses can be. That just, you know, is the guy going to play harder and that's going to paper it over in the playoffs, or are teams just going to like rip this guy apart? So we just don't have a great feel for a lot of these guys. You know, maybe, who knows, Joel Embiid, maybe teams just put him in high pick and roll with the shooter every time and his defensive value is neutralized. You know, Towns, maybe he switches a lot in the playoffs and he's a lot better. You know, you never know necessarily what is going to change there.
So with Cousins, the other part of it is just that he seems so much more comfortable and prefers to spend time offensively more on the perimeter than the interior, even though he's such an undeniable offensive player. And that's what makes him different for me. Why I had him below Jokic is that Jokic does a better job of being Nikola Jokic. Like he uses what he does so much better than Cousins. Cousins is still like their efficiency numbers are still comparable, which is just a note of how insane DeMarcus Cousins is, that he takes worse shots in many ways and still is that efficient. But the defensive stuff and the unreliability, those are real concerns. Also, and then why he's in this tier below a couple guys for me and my next tier is because we don't know exactly what he's going to be. And if it's even a 5% or a 10% reduction, and it could be more than that, then that you know, that's what the margin is right now. So it's going to be tough for him. If he gets to be 100%, I have no problems putting him back where he was, but he's going to have to prove it.
Yeah, and you expect, I mean, especially the defense not being in great shape a lot of his career, though he improved this year in that regard. The propensity to just hang on in the perimeter, maybe take too many jump shots, people might argue. All of that, and then he can struggle to finish around the rim a lot. He can struggle to protect the rim. All of that is simply going to be exacerbated by the Achilles. And you can just, I mean, you could see him coming back and just taking every shot and just not being able to hit him the way he did before the injury. So this might end up being too optimistic. I mean, I could see him coming back and playing the same way he used to, but just not being as effective and, you know, kind of looking like the center version of Isaiah Thomas this year.
With similar defensive effort as well.
But worth noting, by the way, I mean, we've gone through my top seven. I forget exactly where we are on your list. Five of these seven guys shoot three-pointers and shoot them like very easily, very comfortably as a big part of their games. I mean, Gobert and Cousins and Drummond are the only two that don't fall into that category. So that's a pretty remarkable evolution.
We're through six, so it's basically the same.
Yeah.
Okay, so your tier is is Horford, Jokic, Drummond, Cousins.
Yeah,
is that right?
And that takes me through number seven. And then I have a new tier with four guys in it afterwards. But my number eight overall is Steven Adams of the Oklahoma City Thunder, is having one of the best offensive rebounding seasons that we have ever seen.
So he would be seven for me above Cousins. That's basically okay. Cousins is going to be eight. I'll say that right now.
And yeah, you know, Adams... I mean, the more I think about it, the more I think I'm like giving Cousins just like too much benefit of the doubt here for coming back from this Achilles. Like, I probably have him too high.
Let's talk a little bit about Adams. Adams is in many ways closer to what the center position used to be, and I think there's a lot of value to that. The one big difference is that he hasn't been a great defensive rebounder, though I give him credit. I think he's a good box out guy.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
I mean,
it's not like
as long as
the Thunder haven't been a bad defensive rebounding team.
Yeah.
It's just that he doesn't grab them.
Yeah, and with Russell Westbrook and now Carmelo Anthony, like two of the bigger like rebound stealing hogs that we've had in the NBA, that's been the case. I mean, Adams just boxes out. He doesn't care about getting the defensive rebound because, you know, he's all about winning. That's one thing that I really respect about him. I respect his toughness. He always plays hard. His effort level is outstanding. He's got pretty good quickness. I mean, the best of the best can abuse him on switches, but he'll get out there pretty well to a great degree. And, you know, yeah, as you said, they rebound really well when he's on the floor defensively. So I have no concerns about that at all.
He also sets monster screens, and enthusiastically so, which is very important for Oklahoma City's offense and any other team he could theoretically be on. He doesn't play outside of himself offensively. He rolls hard. He finishes if the opportunity is there, but he doesn't really force it too much. That leads to him having a high efficiency on a low usage, even though he's not that dunk everything type guy like DeAndre is or like Clint Capella can be at moments. Like it's a very different thing for him, but
he can still get up for an alley-oop here and there.
Sure, he can. He's just not at their level of finisher to me.
I also like that he can post up at times against smaller players. He actually has one of the better spin moves in the league, that quick baseline spin move. His floater game has improved as well. And then one of the things that he does that maybe Gortat is the only other player in the league that I've seen do much of this is his screening of his own man, screening the help to allow Russell Westbrook, the chemistry that he and Westbrook have, where Westbrook will start a drive, Adams will see that he's gotten past, and instead of trying to screen the guy that Westbrook is being guarded by, he'll just turn around and screen his own man so he can't help, and Westbrook will get a layup. And it's a lot of Westbrook's wide open layups at the rim, if you go back and look, like that's the reason. So he's a very intelligent player, plays hard, and then his ability to basically make Oklahoma City one of the best offensive rebounding teams in the NBA by himself, and then everyone else just gets back on defense so that to get that double, which we saw against the Warriors when they blew them out earlier this week as we record this, to be able to offensive rebound and also get back in transition defense as a team is a great advantage.
We lose track of it sometimes, but he's also younger than some people think just because he's been around for a while. This is his age 24 season. He'll turn 25 in the offseason, so it's reasonable to think that he can improve from here or be at this level for a while, and that's value as well. It doesn't really fit in the criteria, but it's something that we should note.
So he was your seven. Then you had Cousins.
Yeah, Cousins at eight.
So we're at nine now. Who'd you have there?
So this was a real challenge for me. I had DeAndre Jordan here because Jordan is trying to kind of make it, I'm trying to get a read on exactly what he is now because the team has changed over so much, not only with just Chris Paul being gone, but the support talent and all that kind of stuff. And he hasn't been to me nearly as solid defensively. He was always overrated there, probably thanks to Doc, because he's a shot blocker and a rebounder. And those two things, since they can be quantified by counting stats, generally look very good. But he is so good at what he focuses on, and you can see how that can be implemented. And so even though to me he isn't, and at least this year hasn't been what he was the last couple, he's still an incredibly valuable player.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think they're just, if you're gonna inject all these guys with a magic potion that could make them play at like maximum effort level all the time, he'd be way up higher on this list. And when he's really engaged protecting the rim, hitting the offensive glass, cleaning up the defensive boards, he can really be outstanding. But there are just too many times when he just doesn't rotate. He doesn't jump defensively. A Steph Curry comes up, his man Zaza Pachulia or someone will set a screen, and DeAndre will just be chilling in the paint, having lost concentration, and give up a three. You'll see plays like that just too often, like too many errors, too many inconsistencies with him. And then offensively, he too actually deserves a lot of credit for having improved his free throws this year to at least, you know, all right, we're not going to foul this guy intentionally all the time levels, but he's not really much of a pass passer. You know, he doesn't have the type of effect in like the DHO game that someone like Drummond does. I mean, you know, part of that's that the Clippers offense, it doesn't do that as much. He is not really capable of even doing the like take one dribble and make a pass type of plays. You know, if the ball handler gets trapped on the pick and roll, which like a Drummond or a Gobert can do, posting up really just doesn't have the ability to do that. Maybe he'll get right under the rim every once in a while and then they'll just follow him. Obviously, maybe if not the best, one of the two or three best lob catching centers in NBA history, but it's tough for him to ramp up the usage in any way. And I've never been incredibly impressed by his screening ability, his offensive intelligence. I think that there are a lot of times when he's not able to find the seam to get the pass underneath sometimes. So I don't know that he has like the greatest feel for the game in the world, but I mean, the gravity that he has is undeniable. He's an underrated offensive center. So that's, I had him at number nine as well. And then number 10, who I really struggled with, because I think Clint Capella has been better than him this year. And Clint Capella, you can probably argue at this point, has been a better offensive player this year. But it's just the situation that Capella is in is just so incredibly perfect that I just don't know whether it would translate outside of there, even if he is someone who has been able to switch more. He's got more defensive versatility. And I know you love Capella, so I want to hear what you have to say about him. And then also, Capella really can't play more than 30 minutes a game just due to, I forget whether it's like asthma issues or something, but he doesn't play as many minutes and has more of an injury history, although it's not a huge one, than Jordan, who never ever misses time except for like the one sprained ankle that he had this year.
Another consideration for Capella, who is actually the center leader in PER right now, 25.52, and a lot of that is just the ridiculous offensive year that he's having, but also one of his concerns for me has been his defensive rebounding over the course of his career. He's been more in the low to mid 20s. This year he's at 33% for whatever reason, and so I need to see if that's real, because that's more, it's getting closer to DeAndre Jordan territory, and I don't believe that yet with him. And with Capella, I always have trouble, as much as I like him, and I've liked him since he was a draft prospect, because I think he's good at contesting shots, blocking shots, and still getting defensive rebounds, which is the double that made me fall in love with Gobert too originally. And Capella, I think he has craft, but he doesn't have a ton of it. Like, of these limited guys, I like the way that he uses what he has, and I actually like that more than DeAndre, because
his touch around the rim is very underrated,
and his footwork has gotten better too, and he's improved as a free throw shooter as well, though not nearly to the degree of the other guys. He's up to 59% now, but he was at 53 last year, 48% for his career, so we have to really see how that goes. I mean, it's crazy to remember that first year when he barely played for the Rockets, he only made 17% of his free throws, but I wouldn't really weigh that in too much because it was not very many of them. But Capella, like the parallels with DeAndre are there in terms of a guy who catches the ball, makes the quick thing and finishes, but doesn't really do a whole lot else. I actually also like Capella better as a passer, so I'm ready to move Capella ahead of DeAndre, and I'm guessing that if the playoff run goes that way, I'll do it, but I need to see him in that chamber to see really what this is. And it's not necessarily like, oh, he has to dominate whoever's in front of him, but can he hold his own? Can he be a part of that? And also, Capella, if we're talking about the playoffs, though we're focusing on the regular season in this, his minute limitations aren't as big of a deal, because now we're getting to the point where you want to play a lot of small ball centers, like with Houston. So if he can play 20 to 25 minutes a game, so be it. You can use other guys more.
Yeah, and worth noting that we're kind of, the point of these rankings, at least for me, is, okay, you know, if you just place this guy on an average team, you know, how much is he going to boost his team's performance? So that is a concern there. I mean, you're thinking if you've got a guy who is the number 10 center in the NBA, you want him playing 38 minutes a game in the playoffs.
Right. So
if he can handle it.
Sure. Especially if they're good enough to. Yeah.
Yeah.
Though this is right around where the threshold, and that says something about where the center position is going. This is around the threshold where you'd rather play a, not the elite guys, because obviously, you know, you'd rather have Draymond Green at center than a lot of these guys. But this is around the point where you start to have the conversation, which is a big statement in terms of where the center position is.
Yeah. The conversation of, all right, are we better off playing small for part of the year? And I think, you know, if you look at just this, you know, we're at 10 now. My number 11, rounding out tier four, is going to be Marc Gasol. Although this is another one where I'm worrying that maybe I'm just giving too much to him on reputation. His three-point shooting, his distributing has been good. His defense has just been horrendous this year compared to the levels he used to be at. He's older. Maybe that's gone. Maybe it's just he's got to do so much offensively that he just can't be the defensive player that he was. So you don't know. Maybe if you were on another team with some more scoring threats, it'd be a little bit different. But I still think he's a fabulous offensive player, and if he had more around him, we might still be appreciating paying him more, but or we could just say, well, you know, he's 33 now, he's getting pretty close to being done. But the fact that he spaces the floor as well is pretty nice, and so that's why I had him. But yeah, I mean, that's what we're getting to here is, you know, all these wing guys, like, they're going to play 35 minutes a game in the playoffs, whereas big men just naturally can't play as many minutes, but you also just want to bring in other guys as well to give a different look than these traditional centers.
My tier with Drummond, Adams, Cousins, all that did not include Marc Gasol. I'm worried about the defense with him. And yeah, I totally understand that. I titled that tier, the tier that we just finished for me, I titled it A Little Queasy. And then this one originally was called A Little More Queasy because it's just guys that I'm not comfortable with. And I started that with the guy who's probably the ultimate in the I don't know how to feel about them, and that's Hassan Whiteside. Because Hassan Whiteside, you see him at certain moments and you go, oh my God, like there were moments of the Bucks game, which was on Friday before we recorded this, where you go, he's undeniable. Like they can't really do anything with him. And the Bucks are a team that plays traditional fives. You know, he was beasting on John Henson a fair portion of that game. But then you have these moments going, well, is Miami better with him off the floor? And that's what's really crazy with Whiteside.
He's Eric Spoelstra has those moments where he asks himself that question and answers yes a fair amount of the time.
And so that's why I think he's a good representation of this threshold, because he's efficient. I think he's a black hole. I mean, the Whiteside assist thing is something that I've fixated on for about 3 years now, and it's surreal when you think about just the level of zoned in that he can be in that. And defensively, yeah, he's real high in defensive RPM, and Miami has a good defense, but I'm still personally not convinced that he is the reason why their defense is so good. They have a bunch of guys that battle on the perimeter, and I see a lot of other reasons. He certainly helps at moments, but the way that he sometimes chases blocks, the way that he sometimes gets in foul trouble,
never ever leaves the paint under any circumstances defensively.
Him this year, assuming Miami makes the playoffs, I think it'll be a good clarification with him, and also where the NBA is going. But God, I had so much trouble with him.
Yeah, I agree with you. And worth noting too, although he's had a lot of nagging injuries in his career, that he's not necessarily healthy right now. He's got that big ass knee brace on, missed time earlier, has said that he is not 100%. So maybe that's worth noting. But we can also, if we're saying, hey, for the rest of the season, I don't know that we can expect him to really improve much from a health standpoint. Yeah, I mean, I had him at the top of this next year, which I didn't necessarily rank in terms of numbers, but I kind of entitled this one of just solid starters who have some two-way value. And that's a generalization. So I had Whiteside at the top of that tier as well. I mean, that's another one where it's like, he's not even closing games. Is he really making winning plays? You know, I know he has the defensive RPM aspect, which made me feel a little bit better about him because they have not been as good with him on the floor defensively a lot. Another two guys that followed Whiteside for me, and this is again rough ordering at this point for this is what is my tier five, but this is basically like guys like 12 through 22 in the NBA here. But at the top, towards the top of this tier, two guys I think are very underrated at this point, and that's Derek Favors and Pau Gasol.
Pau Gasol, I had some trouble with, and I got into this moment thinking about him and Mark, who I actually have back to back in this, and Pau has had the better season, but he's in a way better situation because the Spurs know what to do with those guys. They're actually competing. The surrounding talent makes more sense with him. They're putting him in a sensible role. So I think Mark is the better player still, but Pau is having the better season because he's in the better spot. But yeah, with both those guys. Yeah.
And he's playing fewer minutes. Yeah. He's not even being asked to close games most of the time. But yeah, on a per minute basis, I mean, he's kind of starting to transition soon, I think, into the realm of guys who I have much lower here, like Nene and David West, of guys who, you know, obviously are old and they can't play as many minutes, but still are probably superior on a per minute basis to a lot of guys who are above them. But Pau Gasol is by far allowing the lowest percentage of shots at the rim to be converted of anyone in the NBA. And he's been perfect in the Spurs system where he can just hang out under the rim and block shots against a lot of teams. And the Spurs are still the number two defense in the NBA with no Leonard and Danny Green hobbled for a lot of the year. I mean, Gasol deserves a decent amount of credit for that.
He does. And I think Gasol could end up being one of those models for just where guys like him go. And we've wondered about this with Greg Monroe and lots of other players. And Gasol Pau is so much more talented than a lot of those guys will end up being. You know, like he's going from Hall of Fame place down to where he is right now. And I think that's a good thing. You know, I think it'll be good for the league, but you know, you appreciate it for what it is. And Derek Favors is interesting because I had him just below the Gasol brothers. And part of it is just because I don't have a good feel yet for how he is as a rim protector because he gets so many of his minutes with Gobert.
He's bad.
And also,
I think pretty much any time that he has been asked to be the center in the last like 4 or 5 years, he has not been adequate as a rim protector, but he could move his feet on the perimeter better than a lot of these guys too.
And also, if you played him at the five with more floor spacing around him, as the Jazz did for portions of this year, especially when Gobert had his more extended absence, their offense looked...
Look what Favors did in the playoffs. That's last true. Year. Like, he was outstanding in that series against the Clippers. I mean, he was putting up, you know, high teens points per game. He's one of the best finishers. He can do a little thing about the dribble. He's actually hitting a corner three here and there now, too. I think he's very, you know, he'd be pretty close to the top of this list outside of, like, the guys that you really, like, run stuff through as far as just, like, an offensive center.
Yeah, I'm good with that. And we're in this part of this list where nobody's perfect, but guys, you know, it's kind of, are you more comfortable with their strengths and their weaknesses? And something I wanted to go take a little break to talk about is...
Well, here, before we take a little break to talk about that, hold that thought. Let's take a little break to talk about Blue Apron, which, because I'm on vacation right now, I cannot eat Blue Apron, which is a shame because I really enjoy doing it. Blue Apron is a food delivery service. In fact, the leading meal kit delivery service in the U.S. So what they do is they deliver fresh pre-portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes to your door. And what that does is it saves you a trip to the store. It saves you a bunch of money compared to buying all of the ingredients for an equivalent meal because everything's portioned out perfectly. There's no food waste, which is something that's definitely a concern. I've really enjoyed a lot of their Asian stuff. They really introduce you to flavors from all over the world. Middle Eastern stuff as well has been fantastic. Or they'll have basics. We had these pimento cheeseburgers, which are awesome, last month. And it's just really nice to cook at home as a family, sit down as a family, or even, you know, if you have roommates, to do it that way too. Just have one day where you're sitting around cooking together, eating together. It makes a difference in the relationships with the people that you live with. And I mean, maybe some of you guys are amazing cooks. I'm not. So I cooked some of the best meals that I've ever cooked in my life with the help of Blue Apron. The way to get started with them, go to blueapron.com/capspace, easy to remember that /capspace URL, and that'll get you $30 off your first order. And of course, let them know that you came from us with that /capspace URL. Once again, go check out the menu. I mean, that's the number one thing. If you're skeptical about it, just go to that blueapron.com/capspace link, and they'll show you all the meals that they have coming up. And I'm guessing that you'll probably be impressed by how good a lot of them sound. blueapron.com/capspace. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Okay, so what point were you going to make before we went to break there?
I'll wait until we finish this tier because I realized that it'll actually get more relevant when we talk about a couple more guys. But I'll say my next guy, it was actually the end of my tier. I felt like I had to draw a line somewhere. And so I'm drawing a line with Miles Turner. Turner is such a talented offensive player. I mean, he can really swing games. I was watching, I'm trying to remember who the Pacers came back. Not the Celtics game, it was the game before that. And he's just so hard for centers to handle at this point. And defensively, he needs to get a lot better. Like, he has the potential to move to either the top of this tier or even into the next tier, but he chases blocks too often and he's not a good defensive rebounder. And so I wonder about how good the Pacers...
And his pick and roll defense...
It's not as good as it should be. And so...
Yeah, and he can't... He doesn't really have the ability to switch out on the perimeter. That's not really...
So you have the kind of Jokic-esque concern of how good can a defense with him as the primary player be? And so do you need to play somebody like Taj Gibson next to him or something at some point? Because then you're giving up a lot offensively compared to what they get with Thad. But still so talented, and I think there are ways that you could use him for teams that you would want him on the floor. And that's kind of the reason I made the separation between him and some of the other guys is the idea of comfort. It's like, okay, you put him out there, you know that it's not perfect, but you feel okay about it. And that's a good place to be, especially right now. And also, I think he's kind of the last of this group where even in a playoff series, I think you want to give him, like, you know, mid to high 20s in minutes if he's game and he can actually do that. Whereas some of the other guys, it's going to be a little bit like there are times that they'll get played off the floor more frequently than I feel like with Turner.
Yeah, Turner, the Pacers have probably been a little bit better with Sabonis at center with the starters than with him. The shot blocking, he is a great pure shot blocker, as you mentioned. He has some offensive limitations too, though. He's not really a guy who can work and make a great decision once he catches in pick and roll if his initial shot is taken away. In the post, he's pretty much limited to even on a switch, catch the ball at 15 feet and then turn over his right shoulder and just try to shoot over the guy, which is, you know, it's just not going to be an efficient shot unless you're Dirk Nowitzki. Even Kristaps Porzingis can't be that efficient on those shots. And his offensive rebounding is negligible, just not a great threat as a role guy. Also, his finishing around the rim, if he can't get it dunk is limited. So that's another concern for him. And just the advanced stats don't like him. He's a negative RPM this season. And so you'd be hard pressed to find statistical evidence that he's been that effective. I do think the shooting is coming along in pick and pop as a 3-point shooter. And we saw him completely destroy Dwight Howard a couple weeks ago. These centers who don't want to come out of the paint can't guard it. But I mean, you know, he'll have games where he never takes a shot inside the paint, or he'll take one or two. And that's concerning. I think he's a player who has such clear strengths and weaknesses on both ends. I mean, there are things he's great at offensively, some things he's really bad at offensively, and then even more so defensively, some things, I guess one thing, shot blocking, that he's great at. And then the rest of the stuff, you know, he's mediocre to below average.
Okay, so
So I think in some ways, I kind of felt bad about having him as high as I did, because they're just, I mean, you look at some of the things that he can do, and you're like, oh yeah, this guy's pretty high, but like, we have not seen statistical evidence in his career that he's
it
that
might
effective.
Not be fair that I trust him more than some of the guys who are a little bit lower on this list, like Yusuf Nurkic, or like,
yeah, and you've always been higher on
I had him over Porzingis as a draft prospect. Yes, around, I have.
Yeah, I mean, I had him around, you know, number 15 in the NBA, so that might be too high for
okay
him,
so then for you, who else is kind of in this area? Because I have a little bit of a line, but it's the most faint line that I felt comfortable drawing. I just didn't want a group that was so big that it was unwieldy.
Yeah. I mean, this is basically almost like every other established starting center in the NBA. And I did kind of cut it off a little bit into another tier, but even that seems very arbitrary to me. And what I tried to do is just look at it as like, all right, who are the guys that you can say are at least average on both ends of the floor? And so, you know, but even those guys you wonder about, right? Like Dwight Howard I had in here, you of course wonder about his locker room influence and his inability to get out of the paint, but he's still a good rim protector. He's still a guy who can get on the offensive glass. He'll control the defensive glass. I mean, I guess maybe you could say he's average on both ends in the right circumstance. I mean, because now we're also getting into like, well, you know, what's the matchup for the guys, right? Like, what is their versatility? How often can they stay on the floor if they're not going up against another traditional center? That becomes difficult. You know, Robin Lopez would probably also be in this area for me. I think Kelly Olynyk is underrated, although I'm probably, that's more skewing towards offense than defense. And then I had four guys here at the bottom of this tier that will probably be a little controversial, but the reason that I like all these guys is I just think they have more positional versatility and can stay on the floor more while still doing some decent things on both ends. So Jakob Poeltl and Bam Adebayo, I may be early on both of those guys in perhaps the same sense that I've been a little late on some of these guys we were talking about earlier, but I think both of those guys are just, you know, excellent rim rollers. Adebayo actually has been like making passes out of the post. He's not a great rim protector yet as a help defender, but his switching has been remarkable. He plays really hard. He's just a huge physical force as well. I mean, I haven't seen really hardly anyone get the better of him, no matter who it is, on a switch defensively all season. And then Poeltl as well has a lot of ability to get on the offensive glass, run in transition. He's a big part of what they do on that second unit. He's a guy that you don't know where those guys could be. It could be, you know, they just get in the playoffs and they fuck up and get into foul trouble and then they're just done and, you know, they don't have the experience. But so I could be overrating them, but I think just their versatility and their mobility and the force and effort that they play with can trump a lot of their more skilled compatriots who I have a little bit below them, who may not have the type of athleticism that they do.
I'm a little bit more cautious with Bam. I've loved what I've seen, but I just want to see more. With Poeltl, I mean, this is going to get into an interesting conversation, which is he a better center right now for the Toronto Raptors than Valanciunas is? And my answer is yes.
I think so too. Yeah. I mean, it's that seems, I
no,
wouldn't
it's
say
close.
Clear
I have
to me,
the...
but maybe there's a, yeah, maybe there's a
okay,
few matchups.
So my next tier, do you have anybody else in this before you move on? Because my next tier, because I just drew an extra line, is very similar to this, but I want to see who you have before I talk about who's different.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is two other controversial ones, and it's Cody Zeller and Tristan Thompson.
Oh, okay. You have Zeller here. That's something I wanted to talk about. Okay.
Tristan Thompson just has not been in shape this year. I think that calf injury really bothered him. I think he's pretty worn out after these long playoff runs the last few years. So a lot of this is based on just what he was able to do going back even to like the 2016 playoff. You know, if he were performing at that level, you know, I think he's right smack in the middle of this tier just with his offensive rebounding and his ability to switch. And he's actually not a horrible finisher around the rim. He's got some nice touch with either hand. Obviously, in what's been such a tire fire for the Cavs. The defense has not been there this year. He has not played well. They had to bring in Larry Nance, I think in part because he's just played so poorly this year. So maybe he just never gets back to that level, but just because of what I think he can be defensively and the level that we see him get to, maybe it's overrating him because, you know, against, he was just so effective against some of these teams that where you have to switch out in the perimeter. But I still had him in there, just again, tough to differentiate, but he provides an element defensively that a lot of these guys don't. And Zeller too, very underrated offensive player, one of the best screeners and rim rollers in the NBA, runs the floor as hard as any center, and the health is certainly a concern, you know, as he's just coming back from this meniscus, but I think his mobility defensively, he protects the rim. They've had no problems defensive rebounding when he's been out there in his career. Unclear if he can play that many minutes, so I certainly would understand if people are like, why do you have these guys that high? But I think that they provide elements that maybe some of the guys below them can't in a modern sense.
Here's the Cody Zeller stat that I wanted to bring up. So last year, he was an RPM darling. He was a very effective player. Last year, him being out basically killed their season.
And this year, he has to play all of his minutes with Frank Kaminsky.
He played 89% of his minutes last year with Kemba Walker, 36% this year.
Yeah.
I think at 100%, he's a better player than Dwight Howard. And Dwight has had a nice year, and he's put in the situation. You could make an argument that Dwight without Kemba would be way more disastrous than Zeller without him. So as a value proposition, there are elements of that that make sense. But he's been hurt by this absolute just train wreck of a bench. And Zeller, it's also weird because his usage rate is low because he's more of a complimentary player. It's just that there's nobody else to really compliment him on this second unit with that the Hornets are running.
Yeah, I mean, being a great screener doesn't help when you're setting a screen for Michael Carter-Williams and they just go under every single time. So I agree with you. I think he's someone who might be underrated at this point.
Let me talk about the guy. So I have two guys in this tier that you didn't. And so I draw in the separation, but yeah, people get confused.
And we're kind of around what? Like around the
20th, something in
like
that range.
25th best players where we are.
And these are both guys that I'm not super comfortable with, but at the same point, you know, it's like, so Nurkic, I wonder how much credit he deserves for the way that the Blazers have defended this year. I mean, a lot of that is system, but, you know, teams aren't shooting well at the rim, and he's an inconsistent, albeit potent at moments, offensive player. Not overall this year. I mean, that's been one of the interesting concerns, is like his true shooting percentage is 516, which is not great for...
That's not great. That is horrendous for a center who's playing with Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum. I mean, he's been a big reason why I think they've disappointed, although certainly there hasn't been as much space for him as there was last year, but nonetheless.
And then the other guy who is having a better year, but again, the context I mentioned it before, is Valanciunas. Valanciunas, he's unspectacular in certain ways because we're so comfortable with what he does well, but I think he fits in this kind of like Cody Zeller type of area. He's also shooting some threes now and actually making some, not enough yet like some of his teammates, where I'm not buying it as being a part of who he is now. And also, he's been a very good defensive rebounder for a while now, and so I like that part of his game. So these are all imperfect players. Nobody's gonna, you know, if anybody checked all the boxes, they'd be way higher, but I think they're in this tier for me.
Yeah, I had Nurkic and Valanciunas at the top of this next tier.
Wait,
just as guys that I don't really see.
I'm trying to remember because we didn't talk about him. Did you have Robin Lopez already? Because I haven't. He's in my next tier. Okay, because we didn't talk about him at all.
Yeah, I mentioned him as being a little bit, just as like being a guy who could be average on both ends. Although again, a guy who has some limitation. But I think he's a little bit better defensively than, like, you know, a Valanciunas to me. His offensive rebounding still makes a difference. He's another good screen setter. But certainly, I mean, you know, you could make the argument that Nurkic is better than Lopez. But Lopez just, you know, knows his role a little bit better than Nurkic. I think that's a problem. I think Nurkic's attitude is a little bit of a problem as well. But yeah, I mean, a lot of this next tier was interesting.
Okay, before we get to the next tier, I want to make the money point I was going to make before. Look at this group and think about the variance in terms of their current contracts and their next contracts. So Hassan Whiteside is getting his max, and I have no idea where his next contract is going to be. Zeller's more in the like low teens area. Kelly Olynyk, you had in this year, I had him in the next one. He got paid, I think, like $15 million this year. And then you have guys on their rookie scale contracts. So there's just, this is the area where I would be very, very, very reluctant to pay guys.
Yeah. And that was the point that we made, I think, at the outside of, like, you know, I've got Aaron Baines, for example, at, like, you know, the number, he's like in like the mid 30s, like for me, could even be a little bit lower than that, you know, or even a Zaza Pachulia or John Henson or Kyle O'Quinn, even someone like Alex Len, who you know, I think if he got into a better system, could be okay. Or Costa Kufos. I mean, those are all guys who, if you had a decent team around them, they could just be a starting center for you. You know, and so why? And yeah, there's a little bit of a drop off between those guys and like a Robin Lopez or a Marcin Gortat or some of these other guys that you mentioned. But it's like, would you rather have Costa Kufos and a wing that you paid $20 million for? Or would you rather have, you know, a Robin Lopez and a wing that you paid like $10 million? You know, I think there's just the amount of money that you pay at other positions just gets you more of a delta than it does here. So that's one of the big lessons to take from this for me. And, you know, so if we want to get into the rest of this list, I mean, that I kind of saw this, the rest of this is like, I know guys who probably can start for you, but have limitations on either end. So I had Nurkic down there a lot because of his inefficiency and the attitude issues. I think he has been good defensively this year, but not a guy you look at as like a defensive stalwart. Valanciunas, Brook Lopez, Marcin Gortat was in this range for me. Get down to Dirk Nowitzki in this range for me as well. Mason Plumlee is probably towards the lower end of this range as well. Nikola Vucevic is at the very, very lower end of this range. I'll say the three guys that I had the hardest time ranking in this next year, though, were Willie Cauley-Stein, Jordan Bell, and Jared Allen.
The sample on those guys for all three of them is a little bit weird, because Cauley-Stein, those first couple years in SAC, it didn't look like he'd figured anything out, but he has been good this year. But he's been playing next to another big for the most part. I've really liked what we've seen from Jared Allen, though.
We've never seen Cauley-Stein get a chance to play, I mean, maybe a little bit with Tolliver last year, but then, you know, Cousins was still there too, right? So we've never really seen Cauley-Stein get a chance to play as like a rim running center and then a switch guy. I mean, his potential in that game where they beat the Warriors at Oracle, granted Curry and Durant didn't play in that one, but you saw he dominated offensively with his ability around the rim, and then his ability to switch defensively was impressive. But he also just takes a lot of dumb shots. He thinks that he's going to be, you know, this like great offensive engine scorer type of guy. You know, doesn't seem to be the most engaged in the locker room, but still a guy who has a lot of potential, and you just wonder what he would look like on a real team.
One guy I don't think I've heard you mention that I really like in this area, I actually have him towards the top of this tier, which is a little bit because I had Nurkic and Valanciunas ahead, so it's a little different than yours, is Dwayne Dedmon. Dedmon is imperfect, but I trust him more defensively than a lot of the guys on this list. And offensively, he doesn't screw you too much. He's not great. He's not going to be, you know, gangbusters. But in this kind of like fringe starter, heavy backup role, I feel more comfortable with him there than a lot of these guys.
And he's made some strides with the jumpers this year as well. He's another guy who, you know, whether it was that illness or who knows, just for whatever reason, just was inexplicably out of the Spurs rotation last year, and they ended up doing just fine without him. So, yeah, I mean, I would have him kind of in like, you know, the high 30s or mid 30s, I would say. I mean, I'd have him below maybe like a Mason Plumlee. And then you also get into like the really good one-way guys here too, like Sabonis, Dirk, whom we mentioned, Enes Kanter, Greg Monroe, Vucevic, whom we mentioned. Like those guys fall into this category too. But yeah, what do you think about Jordan Bell and Jared Allen? I mean, other guys we have not seen a ton from, but kind of seem like, you know, those guys could be in the sort of position I was talking about with Poeltl and Bam Adebayo pretty soon here. But Bell just hasn't played enough, makes some mistakes. He's very slight as well, I think, to the point where that can be, he's going to really struggle to match up against a lot of centers in the post, and they'd have to double. And then Jared Allen, you know, has been the best center on the Nets this year, but also, and has made some strides, but again, you haven't seen him on a real team really playing any kind of high leverage stuff. But a guy whose potential I love.
One big thing that works to those guys' benefits is that they already fit in with the idea of a center who plays fewer minutes and just plays really hard. I think they can do that better than somebody like Marcin Gortat. Gortat's a way more talented player than those guys are. But with where the league is going, I think that you can make that work. And I would, you mentioned Gortat, right? He's in this tier for you. He's in this tier for me for sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So.
Yeah. So, and this tier, this is all, you know, from guys who are like 23 to 35.
And the line between these guys and the ones below is very, it's tough. I mean, I had them just sitting there going like,
yeah,
there are guys that I like better and guys that I like worse here. And so, yeah, those.
Yeah. And a lot of it is just simply like, you know, Enes Kanter just happens to be starting for the Knicks this year because he's on the Knicks, you know, whereas like if it were Ed Davis were on the Warriors, he would probably be their starting center, you know, as opposed to Zaza Pachulia. And he might do a better job than Zaza Pachulia, but it's just Pachulia is a quote unquote starter, even though he gets the Keith Bogans every night and Ed Davis doesn't, but Ed Davis might might be a better player. So, I mean, there's just a lot of, the point we keep making is there's so much interchangeability in this range
and so
for these guys.
A point that I would make for general managers or fans of teams is the reason that you would pay guys above, so what I had is my tier five, so that was the one with Zeller and Nurkic and Dwight. The only reason to really pay guys there or below is if you think there's a very real chance that they can get above that, because the interchangeability of players in that, and that extends here. And think also about the assets that were given up or whatever to get some of these players. So Jordan Bell was a second round pick this year. Jared Allen was a late first. Sabonis was a part of the Paul George trade. How important he was in the Paul George trade is an open question. So you can find guys like this. That's not to say every big man drafted in the late first or early second is going to be this type of guy, but there is that potential to reach this area without expending, you know, a lottery pick on somebody like that.
Here's another way of thinking about this. How many teams in the NBA right now would you say, just looking at their center position, where you said, hey, you know what, if they had good talent around these guys and they were actually trying to win, like their center position isn't good enough, you're just like, hey, these guys got to upgrade at center, like the center position is just killing them, like what teams fall into that category for you? I would say maybe like Brooklyn. Who else? Milwaukee.
Yeah, I would definitely have Milwaukee in that, just because.
Yeah, but even then, you know, Henson's been playing better with the switch.
I think the Lakers. The Lakers would really
Zeller
be helped
now
by better center play.
Yeah, they could play Giannis at center. Yeah. The Lakers. I mean, but they play Julius Randle there. They've got Lopez has been okay. They got Channing Frye now. He could be a,
the Hawks
a
totally
when they were
less than full strength were certainly there, but that's not fair because their guys were hurt. The Suns.
I mean, Alex Len and Tyson Chandler, that's kind of on the borderline. You wonder what those guys would look like if they actually had some talent around them. I don't think they've gotten great. They got Alan Williams too, actually. He's going to come back at some point, presumably. We haven't mentioned the name Rashawn Holmes and Amir Johnson. I mean, those are two guys that, like, I mean, the Magic probably.
Sure.
Could be a little better.
Think about, also, we haven't mentioned Dallas, and Dallas hasn't, you know, depending on how Dirk is quantified in all this, we're counting him as a center. Like, they could, I think a little talent could go a long way, and a lot of that is credit to Rick Carlisle, but they've done a really nice job with imperfect guys.
Yeah, and they've got Dwight Powell, who we wouldn't rank as a center. He plays center there.
And Salamestri's had a nice year too.
This year. Yeah. No, I mean, so like that Dallas is a perfect example of, I mean, how much money Powell, okay, he's making $9 million, maybe a little overpaid, although again, he's been good. You got Maxi Kleba, who has been effective at times. He's making the minimum. Measuri's making the minimum. Nerlens Noel is on a $4 million a year deal and hasn't even really contributed. Dirk is making $5 million, might be worth a little more than that, but probably not a ton more. But like, yeah, you can't say that like that center has been killing the Mavericks this year, and they don't have much in the way of resources invested there. The Warriors are another team, right, that just, you know, they get enough out of the center position. So yeah, I mean, it's there are not many teams, maybe backup center with the Grizz, now that Brandon Wright is gone, Deontay Davis, you know, is not
a good
great
example of the not every center taken in the late first, early second is going to be a great player or a rotation guy.
Well, oh, but that's another interesting one too, is look how many of these guys, not only in terms of how much money they're making now and how they're acquired in the NBA, but just were pretty low draft picks. You know, I mean, I think you can get decent centers in the teens, in the 20s, if you have a guy who has some decent athleticism.
And also look at so I'm going back, I just went off the top of my head to the 2015 draft. Let's count Porzingis as a four, because that's what we did in this exercise. There were five centers, depending on how we count Kaminsky, taken in the first 11 picks of that draft. Towns made this list high. Turner was, you know, kind of in that, still in a decent tier. Like, I think that's definitely a good pick for them. Okafor is a fringe rotation guy. Cauley-Stein is barely on this list. And then Kaminsky, even if he counted as a center, wouldn't be on this list.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, whether it's in the draft or whether it's in free agency, if you're going to commit big, and I think especially in free agency too, it's the years as well, you know, as you always say. But if you're going to commit a large number of years at eight figures per season, or even a guy like Kufos, right? Like, he was $8 million a year for 4 years. You know, that's way too much for him. You know, I mean, they've gotten maybe slightly above replacement level, but replacement level is higher at the center position than anywhere else, especially given the ability to move guys over from other positions. So yeah, I mean, if you're drafting a guy high who's a center, or you're making an eight-figure multi-year commitment in free agency to a guy who's a center, you Gamewell better be sure that he's got the ability to be special. Like, I want, if it's not a guy that we think could be on the top 10 of this list, I mean, a guy that you would want playing more than 25 minutes a game, that you see him as that kind of player, do not make that commit, because you can get 80% of that for very small expenditure.
And that's also true in terms of trading for guys. I mean, so many of these guys have long-term contracts already. So, like, I wouldn't be sitting there going, oh, we can get Tristan Thompson. You know, look, he's making, you know, like 15, he's making like $18 million a year at this point. Like, all these guys, and the sheer volume of contracts right now, the market correction on this is going to take probably 4 years just because of how long these guys are already getting paid. And teams would, you could take one of these guys in a salary dump, and then you could get an asset in return, and that might even be better in certain circumstances.
So it's going to be very interesting, some of the free agents, some of these guys who are free coming up here. Yusuf Nurkic is one of them, right? Like, I mean, to me, I'm just not interested in giving him, like, I don't want to give him 4 years, and I wouldn't really want to give him more than like $10 million a year. And even that could end up being a lot, right? I mean, you can just look at, it's just the opportunity cost, right? Like, think of what else Portland could be doing if they could use like their full mid-level on a wing instead of having to re-sign Nurkic, and then just, you know, all right, you got Zach Collins, maybe you could bring back Ed Davis, or it's just a lot of things that would be available. The restricted free agency of Clint Capella will be absolutely fascinating. That's I know you're locked in on that one.
I am, and restricted free agency is such a messed up thing in general, but for these type of guys, it's really going to be, is anybody willing to do the Otto Porter, Alan Crabb type thing and say, this is our guy, even if we don't get him, this is a worthwhile investment. And one other point that I want to make with this, because you and I haven't focused on the draft, so we can't add in our own evaluation. From what I have heard, this year's draft is loaded in centers too, and that, no matter what, it affects the supply and the playing time. However, how many of those guys move and affect this list, we'll have to wait. And so that affects how you think about these centers and the resources that you do, because if they're, you know, if there's a guy that Portland can take with their first round pick, then that's an even stronger reason, like, let's say, you know, with a late lottery pick, or even Zach Collins, who they took last year. Like, it's such, like, just don't pay these guys. Just really, really don't pay these guys.
Yeah, which is too bad, because these are guys who work hard on their games.
Sure.
They're skilled, but yeah.
It's a resource allocation game.
NBA,
that's what this
difficult.
Is.
Yeah.
And scarcity matters.
It's like the running back position in football, almost, mm-hmm. at this point.
Where it's really important, but there are so many guys that can do it, and you can use them in different ways. And I'm really a big fan, unless you know exactly what you want from your center, of getting some different guys and then mixing and matching as the situation presents itself. I've enjoyed there are some teams that can even do that with their backup centers. They have one guy who makes more sense against certain teams, and another guy like Boban has been used in this way at certain moments in time. And you talked about Clint Capella being an interesting one. The other guy that I think is maybe the most challenging guy to predict in all of this is Favors, because what he wants, what another team wants, who is going to say that he's there, and because he's unrestricted as opposed to all these other guys that are restricted, but he's still young. Like, maybe a team would say, hey, we'd rather have Clint Capella, but we're never going to get Clint Capella, so we can get Favors. But at the same point, maybe he gets the mid-level exception and just ends up being a really nice contract.
Yeah, I mean, well, and that's why when we were talking about the trade deadline the other day, I was like, especially now with he and Gobert playing better together, they've now won 8 straight with those two guys getting significant minutes together. You know, they're not just like trying to split those guys up as soon as possible. And with Joe Johnson gone there, I guess when Crowder is there, he'll be a more stretch four option too. But, you know, maybe Utah just says, hey, you know what, Derek, like 2 years, $23 million, just come back here. Maybe that's his best offer, you know, maybe because they'll have his bird rights. They can offer him more than the mid-level. I don't see any cap space team wanting to sign him for more than the mid-level. And even, you know, maybe there's a team that might want to go 3 or 4 years with the mid-level, but you know, maybe he does end up coming back to Utah. That's and playing power forward. So maybe he shouldn't be on the center list, but I think for most teams in the league, he would be a center. This has been enlightening. We should probably wrap this up here. Don't forget our sponsor, Blue Apron, blueapron.com/capspace, and also Indochino. Use that capspace code, get any premium suit for $359. We'll be back on Thursday night once the All-Star break is over to catch you up on all the happening. Until then, thanks for bearing with us on vacation. We got to do it every once in a while. Talk to y'all next time.